You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 6th of October, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. I've been away earlier this week, and this is my first day back. And as it's Thursday, it means we also have with us today geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. I just saw a picture of Kanye West wearing a White Lives Matter shirt next to Candace Owens. And I tell you, things are taking twists that even I couldn't have predicted. So our lives are getting more and more interesting as time goes on.
It certainly seems that way, doesn't it? I've seen that picture as well. I was very impressed with that. That is excellent that he is getting that message out to all his followers. And this is another message that we're going to be talking about today, which seems to be reaching a lot of people. And this is Putin's annexation speech and the topics that he discussed. A lot of people were really impressed with this, and some people were critical of some aspects of it. But as you said to me before we started here, Matt, you've got to take what we're given. And this is certainly a very big turn up for the book. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at some selected highlights from Putin's annexation speech, which was the speech that he gave before he accepted the Donbass regions as a part of Russia. In 1991, in Belovskaya Pusha, representatives of the party elite of that time made a decision to terminate the Soviet Union without asking ordinary citizens what they wanted, and people suddenly found themselves cut off from their homeland. This tore apart and dismembered our national community and triggered a national catastrophe. Just like the government quietly demarcated the borders of Soviet republics, acting behind the scenes after the 1917 revolution, the last leaders of the Soviet Union, contrary to the direct expression of the will of the majority of people in the referendum of 1991, destroyed our great country and simply made the people in the former republics face this as an accomplished fact. I can admit that they didn't even know what they were doing and what consequences their actions would have in the end. But it doesn't matter now. There is no Soviet Union anymore, and we cannot return to the past. Actually, Russia no longer needs it today. This isn't our ambition, but there is nothing stronger than the determination of millions of people who, by their culture, religion, traditions, and language, consider themselves a part of Russia, whose ancestors lived in a single country for centuries. There is nothing stronger than their determination to return to their true historical homeland. And I'm aware of the second paragraph there, but in this first paragraph here about a referendum of 1991, where the government went against what the majority of the people wanted and destroyed the Soviet Union, that was the first that I've ever heard of that, Matt. So perhaps you'd like to comment on that bit first.
Well, he's setting the stage here, and it's really important. It's one of the reasons I included it. There was a union-wide referendum that year. I was in college. I remember reading about it, and it was a huge percentage. I mean, the question was, would you like to preserve the Soviet Union in its present form? And a giant majority said yes, for a whole bunch of reasons. Ethnic is probably one of them. And the point of all of this is that he's saying that now, because of that dissolution of the USSR into the CIS, which really never went anywhere, you have Russians stuck all over Central Asia and western parts of the former empire. And that means a dissolution of the USSR, among many other things, caused a huge amount of anxiety in the Baltics especially. So they were all cut off. and they created a very strong, as you might expect, a very strong ethnic consciousness, especially in eastern Ukraine, given everything that they've been put through. And of course, that August of 91, you had the very poor coup attempt, which I've written on and spoken on extensively, because so much of what that coup, those coup plotters said, is exactly what Putin is saying today. So that's very, very significant. So you have two layers of artificiality. The first was what the Soviet Union drew as the borders. And then secondly, what the dissolution of the USSR developed in terms of borders. So you have numerous, and this is why Ukraine is the way it is. No way would, even the Donbass voted to eventually leave the USSR, just because the USSR in effect didn't exist. And the economy was almost gone by that point. Now, of course, everything has changed. The Russian economy is a bit larger than Canada's, I think the seventh or eighth largest in the world. And Ukraine is like Ghana or Niger today, in terms, not just in terms of the economy, but in terms of corruption. There is no one. You could be a fanatical Ukrainian nationalist and you want nothing to do with the Kiev government.
Well, you could say that there is a similarity then, couldn't you, between these Russian minorities that were left in these countries, like such as the ones in the Baltics and in the east of Russia, and you could say that there is a similarity between them and the Jewish experience of being a minority with the out-group. And we know that what that did, it caused a very, very strong sense of ethnocentrism within the Jews. So you would expect there to be a very, very strong sense of ethnocentrism within these people of Russian ethnicity that are in places like the east of Ukraine. And that is what we have seen. Getting back to what Putin says here, for 8 long years, people in Donbass were subjected to genocide, shelling and blockades. In Kherson and Zaporizhia, a criminal policy was pursued to cultivate hatred for Russia, for everything Russian. Now too, during the referendums, the Kiev regime threatened schoolteachers, women who worked in election commissions, with reprisals and death. Kiev threatened millions of people who came to express their will with repression. But the people of Donbass, Zaporizhia and Kherson were not broken, and they had their say. I want the Kiev authorities and their true handlers in the West to hear me now, and I want everyone to remember this. The people living in Lugansk and Donetsk, in Kherson and Zaporizhia, have become our citizens forever. We call on the Kiev regime to immediately cease fire and all hostilities, to end the war it unleashed back in 2014, and return to the negotiating table. We are ready for this, as we have said more than once. But the choice of the people in Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporizhia and Kherson will not be discussed. The decision has been made, and Russia will not betray it. Kiev's current authority should respect this free expression of the people's will. There is no other way. This is the only way to peace. And of course, the West is just going to say, well, you don't even have the complete occupation of that area. How can you say that it's not going to go back to Ukraine when certain parts of that area are now occupied by Ukraine and not by Russia? So what do you make of that, Matt?
Well, the real tragedy is these very, you know, I just published a paper on my Patreon explaining this in great detail from September to now. These strategic retreats from these little towns like Liman leaves open people who voted for union with independence, then union with Russia, to reprisals. These are all very pro-Russian areas. I mean, there's huge Russia support in central Ukraine, Carpatho Rus in the west, which no one is talking about, and in the southern part. You have pro-Russian, the pro-Russian mentality is everywhere. At the very least, even if this stuff wasn't true, of course the Eastern Republics are going to want to join Russia or at least be independent, because the Ukrainian economy up until 2014 was very dependent on them. This was the coal region. This was the steel region. This was the heavy region of heavy industry and electronics. And so when they sent governors, that Yatsenyuk after the revolution in 14, sent governors to liquidate these places, all of these institutions, and sell, you know, give it away as to pay debt, and selling this off to oil and natural gas companies from the West. That's where this counter-revolution took place in the so-called Russian Spring. So even if there was no war, even if there was no violence against them, even if their media wasn't banned and everything else, even if all that was normal, they would still vote to leave. No one could possibly ever want to have anything to do with a fourth world backwater that what Ukraine has turned into. I'm guaranteeing you, and I've been following this for a long time, most Ukrainians realize that the West is at stake here. They've created it. They've created these disasters. Ukraine was at the negotiating table in early March, and the UK and the US demanded that they leave. They knew that there was no chance. Well, what would they even want with eastern Ukraine? It's just going to be a Northern Ireland for them. They have the East has very professional militias trained by Russia over the last few years. They've had victory after victory against the Ukrainian forces in that same period of time. They've defended their independence. The Ukrainian position comes strictly from London and Washington, has no connection at all to their own will. And they're dealing now with a problem of Ukrainians from the central and western areas trying to get to the east, and many of them trying to get to Russia. So many of the deserters in these mercenary forces in the Ukrainian army is coming through this area, and some of them are going north to Belarus. As I've said before, this is why Putin needed to streamline and make it very easy to get Russian citizenship for all of these people, because there's simply so many of them. So remember, my reports are that about 70% of those fighting in the East are mercenaries for Ukraine, from the Middle East, from the Baltics, from Georgia, even from the West. So these aren't Ukrainian soldiers. Ukrainian soldiers have already shown many years ago that they're not willing to fire on other Ukrainians, even those living in the East. They can't be trusted. These are all well-trained Western mercenaries, but they also have no loyalty to anything. Russian forces and the militia forces, who are also regulars in that part of the country, are extremely motivated. So regardless of who occupies what, that has nothing to do with the fact that this vote was done under extreme Kievan duress, that you had 100 observers from 100 different countries all signing off on this. No one could possibly think that it would be any lower than the percentages that they registered, in the 80s and 90s. But you had about a 67% turnout only because of these threats. And in the same paper that I have on Patreon, I go in great detail as to how the Kiev / U.S. government has deliberately bombed civilian centers on purpose. I have witnesses talking about the deliberate bombing of ambulances, fire trucks, EMTs, hospitals, to simply break their will and get them to surrender just out of sheer exhaustion. And again, one of the many reasons that Russia was forced to invade. So really one issue has nothing to do with the other. No one could be shocked here. And there's people speaking Ukrainian, many people speaking Ukrainian over there who voted to join Russia, at least for economic reasons. But Kiev, since it's a colonial administration under the U.S. and the U.K., has angered so many people, including its own supporters. You've had some of the militias simply give up, saying, we're not fighting for this government anymore. None of this gets into the Western press, of course. This was a pretty brilliant move, and they totally delegitimized the Western narrative here.
So you think similar to with the partition in India, when we had all the Muslims move to Pakistan and all the Hindus move to India, we can see all the Russian speakers moving to the Donbass. We also have Russia that is pointing out that this is in tune with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and this is the right to self-determination. But then, of course, Zelensky has just signed a decree that Ukraine will not negotiate, all the while that Putin is the president of Russia. Getting back to Putin's speech here, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the West decided that the world and all of us would permanently accede to its dictates. In 1991, the West thought that Russia would never rise after such shocks and would fall to pieces on its own. And this almost happened. We remember the horrible 1990s, hungry, cold, and hopeless. But Russia remained standing, came alive, grew stronger, and occupied its rightful place in the world. Meanwhile, the West continued and continues looking for another chance to strike a blow at us, to weaken and break up Russia, which they have always dreamed about, to divide our state and set our peoples against each other, and to condemn them to poverty and extinction. They cannot rest easy knowing that there is such a great country with this huge territory in the world, with its natural wealth, resources, and people who cannot and will not do someone else's bidding. The West is ready to cross every line to preserve the neo-colonial system, which allows it to live off the world, to plunder it thanks to the domination of the dollar and technology, to collect an actual tribute from humanity, to extract its primary source of unearned prosperity, the rent paid to the hegemon. The preservation of this annuity is their main, real, and absolutely self-serving motivation. This is why total de-sovereignization is in their interest. This explains their aggression towards independent states, traditional values, and authentic cultures, their attempts to undermine international and integration processes, new global currencies, and technological development centers that they cannot control. It is critically important for them to force all countries to surrender their sovereignty to the United States. In certain countries, the ruling elites voluntarily agree to do this. Voluntarily agree to become vassals. Others are bribed or intimidated. And if this does not work, they destroy entire states, leaving behind humanitarian disasters, devastation, ruins, millions of wrecked and mangled human lives, terrorist enclaves, social disaster zones, protectorates, colonies, and semi-colonies. They don't care. All they care about is their own benefit. So where he's saying here, de-sovereignization is in their interest, which is basically denationalization. This is the root of this anti-nationalist ideology that they have in the West. Do you think, Matt?
Of course. If you could summarize what we've been talking about on this show for the last whole bunch of years, it's this. If you could summarize my career in this field, it's this. Comparative politics, international affairs has been a huge area since this very time, since the early 90s. The whole concept of globalization and now the Great Reset is to allow this oligarchy, these handful of companies and banks to plunder the entire planet, to get cheap raw materials, cheap labor. And in the process, of course, not passing on savings to the consumer, but of course, just pocketing this huge profit. I was saying when Yeltsin was president of Russia, the Russian Imperial Union Order, the National Traditionalist Caucus, groups like this, where we were all saying that Russia alone has the size, has the ideology, has the military, has the ideological tradition, the church, all these institutions, the ability to be independent, autarchic. And not to be in need of, not to be dependent on anybody. They have everything they need in their borders. That in the right leadership, this is going to be the break against what back then we used to call the New World Order. And of course, when Putin took over, I watched so very carefully how he rebuilt the state, and then with the state rebuilt the economy, and then confidence went through the roof, ending the war in Chechnya and everything else. This is what he's saying, because he's done this, because it's not just Russia. Russia has built the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They're a part of the Belt and Road Initiative, of course, BRICS, which is going to unify their currencies in order to make war on the dollar. The Bank of the South, which was General Chavez's dream in Venezuela. It's an entire coalition. There's a German political scientist, his last name is Warwick, I believe. I've quoted him recently, that says this war is a disaster. Because what it's doing is it's creating even deeper ties amongst this anti-American coalition, this national Eurasianist, whatever you want to call it, coalition against globalization. Nations are pretty much the only break on corporate expansion, keeping wages as low as humanly possible, austerity measures, breaking down the state, breaking down any social safety net, destroying immunization, and on and on and on. And promoting sick ideologies, which is also a part of how the capitalists expand and destroy any kind of opposition by destroying their moral fiber and breaking down their morale. My book, Russian Populist, as far as I know, is still the only English language treatment of Putin's political philosophy. Yes, it came out before Fury and before these events, but nothing has changed. And I say there, this is the core of why this man is president, why he's popular, and why he's successful. I love the idea of unearned prosperity. The economic term for that is rent, because they have a position of political prominence, thanks to the dollar or the military or whatever, they can use that to extract even more resources. And because so much of this is based on debt and compound interest, none of it has to do with actual production. Production has been sent to the third and fourth worlds. It's subsidized by the U.S. government to do that. And yet that's weakened the country. It's hollowed it out. It's destroyed morale in America. Now, all of a sudden, the blue collar working class can be attacked and assaulted. That's what the left is doing now, because these are especially whites who are voting for Trump almost exclusively. Now, all of a sudden, the working class has no interest, and it's all these sexual freaks that are at the center of leftist thinking. And it's because these corporations are promoting leftist ideology and globalization and the hatred of everything from the family to the nation to the church, no matter where you go. And they need, capitalism needs this ideology to justify it. Globalization requires a global ideology that refuses to recognize any natural law or even any cultural particularity. And Putin talks about authentic cultures rather than the media-created cultures that we live under, the anti-cultures that they created in the West, worshiping celebrities, with the Jewish domination and everything else. And of course, everything is now ideological. So this absolutely self-serving motivation, we've been talking about that for years. And Putin has never quite put it so succinctly, because now the war is, whatever gloves were on are now gone. That's extremely important.
Well, he talks there about them going after tradition, going after people's cultures. And then he also mentions the fact that Russia has a culture that's existed for thousands of years. And why is there not room for different cultures, different traditions? Why does everything have to be done in the same way that America dictates? Well, continuing with what he says here, he says the West is counting on impunity, on being able to get away with anything. As a matter of fact, this was actually the case until recently. Strategic security agreements have been trashed. Agreements reached at the highest political level have been declared tall tales. Firm promises not to expand NATO to the east gave way to dirty deception as soon as our former leaders bought into them. Missile defense, intermediate range, and shorter range missile treaties have been unilaterally dismantled under far-fetched pretexts, and all we hear is the West is insisting on a rules-based order. Where did that come from anyway? Who has ever seen these rules? Who agreed or approved them? Listen, this is just a lot of nonsense, utter deceit, double standards, or even triple standards. They must think we're stupid. And of course, the rules-based order is something you've spoken about lots of times, Matt, isn't it? International law. What do you make of what he's saying here?
Well, on occasion, Putin actually makes reference to international law. Referring to something in the international arena as legal or illegal is absurd. The same people who have written these dictates today are the same ones who wrote it yesterday. International law to me is absolutely meaningless. The victors after World War II created the UN and Bretton Woods and the rest to enshrine capitalism in their longstanding cooperation with Marxism in the USSR. But once that prophet fell off in the 1970s, suddenly the USSR became a right-wing power that had to be destroyed. And the whole concept is, the evolutionary doctrine says that whoever wins in this battle for survival is there's no morality, but in essence that they won because they're better, and then they have a right to absorb the resources of who've been defeated, and speaking in simple terms. That's why the British Empire accepted the evolutionary doctrine and everything that went along with it. It justified the empire and it justified the huge conglomerates in this industrial revolution. Here, it has to do with the destruction, of course, of Germany in World War II and then the USSR in 1991. All that's left is liberal capitalism that now functions and survives no different than the Soviet system, just a little bit more more ethereal in how it functions. It's not as crude as the USSR. But now the American exceptionalism says we've defeated all comers and therefore we have a right to the world. And that's why – and that's what Fukuyama talked about. And that's really what Putin is talking about here. We're not – the U.S. says we're not bound by nuclear treaties. All of a sudden there's no anti-nuke movement. There's no anti-war movement anywhere. And yet in the late 60s, it convulsed the world. In the 80s, the anti-nuke movement convulsed Europe. Now that the enemy is a nationalist one, the Western world suddenly – the left has become violent hawks. The anti-war movement is gone. There are, whatever there is arrested and removed. And it was Trump that pulled the U.S. out of the nuclear missile treaties, short and medium range. Short and medium range are really the most dangerous because they could be fired from Romania or Poland or Bulgaria, wherever they're being sent. So that's really the foundation of this, some variation of the evolutionary doctrine that because both Germany and the USSR fell, the U.S. now has a right to the planet. We're the ones who won. Therefore, in an evolutionary scheme, we have a right to rule. The problem is that their myths, their stories that they tell about why they function versus how they actually function means that they're no different from any other system that they claim to hate, except they do it under the guise of freedom and prosperity. But ultimately, as he talks about here, especially in the third world, it's a tiny clique of wealthy people who are totally dependent on the Japan or Western Europe, and they rule. Often coming from American universities, et cetera, they rule the third world. And they have to manipulate people in a Machiavellian way because they have no right to be where they are. And that's what he means by this bribery and all the rest. No one can deny that that's also meant. Anybody who opposes them will see their country wrecked, mangled, and destroyed. No one can deny it. And as I've said 100 times, mangling and destroying these countries, Libya, Iraq, at Sudan, this is trying to do it to Iran, is because so many of these countries with nationalist and even national socialist governments like you have in Iran, they're at first world status or very close to first world status as it was in Libya and Iraq. That's why the nuclear program is under attack. That's why the Israelis bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor. It wasn't a weapons factory. It was bringing them away from the oil economy to first world high tech status. That's why these countries have to be destroyed. They're being destroyed because they were successful. Liberal democracy fails everywhere in the third world. And that's, I think, what Putin is talking about here.
They were successful on their own terms instead of just having the limited success that would be dished out by the US. Getting back to what Putin says here, Western countries have been saying for centuries that they bring freedom and democracy to other nations. Nothing could be further from the truth. Instead of bringing democracy, they suppressed and exploited. And instead of giving freedom, they enslaved and oppressed. The unipolar world is inherently anti-democratic and unfree. It is false and hypocritical through and through. The United States is the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons twice, destroying the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. And they created a precedent. Recall that during World War II, the United States and Britain reduced Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, and many other German cities to rubble without the least military necessity. It was done ostentatiously and, to repeat, without any military necessity. They had only one goal, as with the nuclear bombing of Japanese cities, to intimidate our country and the rest of the world. And I'm really surprised here that he mentions Dresden, Hamburg, and Cologne. I mean, that's really sort of showing sympathy for the Germans here. And we're used to him talking about the glorious Red Army and how they conquered Germany. So, I mean, that really is a turn up for the books to see him talking about the terror bombing of Germany, don't you think?
Yes, and that's why I included it here. He's hinted at that elsewhere, too. Remember, he speaks German without an accent. He was stationed in East Germany for a very long time. He's very pro-German, but the Russian contempt for the Third Reich really only has to do with the fact that they invaded the Soviet Union, hence Russia. That's really the issue. If they had never done this, if things were normal in the East and Germany sent its forces west, it would have been a very different story. But they also realize, and Putin being well-versed in history, especially German history, is aware that all of the flattening of Japan and Germany, reducing them to subhumanity, killing POWs, killing German migrants fleeing the firebombing, same thing for Japan, this comes from their dehumanization. Remember, attacking Russia as this half-Asiatic, ignorant people, that's mainstream now. All of a sudden, this kind of racism is perfectly okay. It's okay to hate them, and to a lesser extent China, because at least Russians are white. But to hate them is perfectly acceptable, to throw them out of countries. That all of a sudden, their anti-racism stuff goes out the window. This, again, this is just more American exceptionalism. You have to dehumanize before you destroy. You can't slaughter people without dehumanizing. And that's exactly what happened in World War II. The propaganda, the crude American propaganda about Germany and Japan in the mid-40s justified the mass slaughter of civilians. In the paper I just mentioned that I just published on Patreon, my Patreon, one of the women, Eve Bartlett, spent a lot of time in the Gaza Strip and now has been doing some investigations in eastern Ukraine. And she says the treatment, the strategy of civilians is absolutely identical, especially in the West Bank on the one hand and the new republics to the east on the other hand. The deliberate attacks on civilian centers, pushing pornography to demoralize them. The dehumanization agenda in the press, total press control, total media blackout, shooting ambulance drivers. She says, I can't believe the how identical this, not only the policies are, but the justifications. And this is very important. Putin, you know, the problem with Germany was the invasion of the USSR, period. Anything else is no problem. Putin is extremely pro-German in every other respect. And that's why he mentions this. This is just simply how the West operates, and they're able to slaughter all these people because liberalism had the right to rule the world. At the time, they were cooperating with the USSR, fully aware, and later on too, fully aware that eventually it's going to fall or reform itself to become liberal. And he'll talk more about this in a little bit here. But this is – I'm very happy he said this. But this is normal for liberal countries.
Continuing, at the same time, the West has clearly been engaged in wishful thinking for a long time. In launching the sanctions blitzkrieg against Russia, for example, they thought that they could once again line up the whole world at their command. As it turns out, however, such a bright prospect does not excite everyone, other than complete political masochists and admirers of other unconventional forms of international relations. Most states refuse to snap a salute and instead choose the sensible path of cooperation with Russia. The West clearly did not expect such insubordination. They simply got used to acting according to a template, to grab whatever they please by blackmail, bribery, intimidation, and convinced themselves that these methods would work forever, as if they had fossilized in the past. Such self-confidence is a direct product not only of the notorious concept of exceptionalism, although it never ceases to amaze, but also of the real information hunger in the West. So is he talking there about the way that we are deprived of truthful news here in the West, do you think, Matt? Because, of course, people in the West here will say, well, Russia is deprived of the truthful news. They just have one set of journalists, one set of news, and it's all owned by the state. They don't have the plurality that we have. And of course, that's the West's argument. Do you think that's what he's referring to here, this information hunger in the West?
Oh, yeah, I know he is. And he's mentioned this before. He's well aware that Sputnik and RT are banned in at least in the UK. I'm not sure where else in Western Europe, that anyone who speaks up and being a basic common sense in terms of Russia policy today is hounded out of existence. And you know, we've mentioned this before. Well, of course, to answer, I know you're being devil's advocate here, but Russia has a far more diverse media than the West has. The West has a handful of corporations that control everything, and of course, the state has a big role in this. Yeah, the Russian state has a right to defend itself like anybody else, and realizes what the Western press is. And they were trying to, and they did buy out a lot of the Washington Post tried to buy out a lot of Russian media, Media Most and Moscow Times and things like that are owned or used to be owned by the West, especially the Washington Post. This is where state media comes in. Russia has no more state media than the U.S. does. You know, the BBC is state media too, but and the Canadian Broadcasting, all this. But they have far greater diversity and far more detailed and balanced coverage. I go to the Russian press. The Russian press can be vehemently critical of Vladimir Putin, but they could also be very much in favor of it. You have far fewer strictures. I mean, Russian journalists actually try to be journalists, not the American storytellers. But this is extremely important. The American exceptionalism creates this bubble that we talk about all the time. the idea that the debates are all settled. The whole point of Francis Fukuyama's book was the debates, there's no more debate. Major areas of policy, it's just established, history's on our side, there is no debate. That's why they ban us. Well, the debate is over, there's nothing there. And after that, you live in a bubble. These people start believing their own BS. And how could anyone possibly oppose us? They must be insane. There's got to be something wrong with them. They must have ill will. And when they realize that millions or billions of people accept that and reject the West and reject everything they stand for, they really don't know what to do. They start developing cognitive dissonance, which is a really nasty thing to have to live with unless you're a sociopath. Sociopaths will have the advantage in that case. And the fact that, you know, how many times have I said the West is kind of like, you know, multi-billionaire that lost all his money overnight and is still not used to that and is still walking around giving orders to people and everyone laughs at him. You know, I think of Montgomery Burns when he lost his money. You know, they don't know how else to act. And when they get pushback, they're getting a lot of pushback, they start lashing out. I've used that phrase 100 times here on this show. The West starts lashing out not only when they get all this pushback, but when their own economy starts to collapse fundamentally. He's getting, and the West is getting pushback everywhere. You know, Brazil, most of Latin America, most of Southeast Asia, Russia, and Central Asia wants nothing to do. The Chinese offer a far greater and freer package of trade and financial assistance without the profit motive. The West, of course, can't claim that. So these guys just rage because they don't really know what else to do. This is all they're used to. And when their bubble bursts, you know, you better get out of the way.
Continuing with the speech, and here it is important to recall that the West bailed itself out of its early 20th century challenges with World War I. Profits from World War II helped the United States finally overcome the Great Depression and become the largest economy in the world, and to impose on the planet the power of the dollar as a global reserve currency. In the 1980s crisis, things came to a head in the 1980s again. The West emerged from it unscathed, largely by appropriating the inheritance and resources of the collapsed and defunct Soviet Union. That's a fact. Now, in order to free itself from the latest web of challenges, they need to dismantle Russia as well as other states that choose a sovereign path of development at all costs to be able to further plunder other nations' wealth and use it to patch their own holes. If this does not happen, I cannot rule out that they will try to trigger a collapse of the entire system and blame everything on that, or, God forbid, decide to use the old formula of economic growth through war. Now, did the West really make that much out of the resources of the collapsed Soviet Union, Matt?
Well, what he means here, and of course he was there in East Germany at the time, Western corporations moved into Eastern and Central Europe because you had a semi-unionized, very literate and technically advanced labor force. And, you know, once the states rebuilt themselves, that changed. But think of what Ukraine has done or tried to do in the East, liquidating any profitable company in order to pay down debt. Even you know, 30 years ago, private and public sector debt was a huge issue. Since the West doesn't actually produce anything anymore, all they really can do is just strip mine. Just take productive assets and liquidate them. And the Russian oligarchy, of course, almost exclusively Jewish, still has billions of dollars, usually dollars, in Western bank accounts. It's kind of like in 2008, 2009, the stock market crashed, and again, a few years later, we began to realize, and so did the SEC, that huge amounts of laundered drug money coming from Latin America, Mexico, et cetera, was the only thing keeping the stock market going. So what Putin is saying is that the West as a whole is doing this or did this to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, tried and failed to do it in China. The whole point of the color revolution is to open up these countries to a flood of Western investment, in which case they would destroy local industry. The state wouldn't have much power. And then they could use that market, use those raw materials, use that labor. What's interesting about the former Soviet Union is the very high level of literacy and the high level of scientific education, something that Moscow State set the standard for. Yeah, the fact that the Soviet Union did it is a problem, but it doesn't matter. They still had a very, very powerful scientific establishment, many of them educated in the West. So that was the point here. That's the point he's trying to make. Tiananmen Square, that make-believe event in the late 80s, that was an attempt to overthrow the Chinese government, in which case they would go in and do the same thing. So because you don't have a lot of production, you have financial instruments being considered economic growth, they have to take whatever's nailed down in order to, you know, to pay off debt, to keep their expenses low, to lower transaction costs, to destroy unions and cultures and everything else. This is all they know right now, especially since long-term confidence in the system is non-existent. If you don't have any confidence of the medium or long term, you're just going to strip everything you can, not worrying about production. So he's right here. And the only problem is, of course, Putin stopped it. The oil and gas industries was going to be sold off by Khodorkovsky, and he had him arrested before he can do that. That's what was a seminal event. So they nationalized this. By the way, the Eastern Ukrainian republics have nationalized the oligarchs' property, which is a big deal, and including, you know, Western-backed Ukrainian investors over there. They've all been nationalized. This is theirs, and that's kind of his whole point. When the West realized they couldn't do that anymore, suddenly they're demonizing Russia, beyond imagination.
Well, finishing up here, he says, they do not give a damn about the natural right of billions of people, the majority of humanity, to freedom and justice, the right to determine their own future. They have already moved on to the radical denial of moral, religious, and family values. Let's answer some very simple questions for ourselves. Now, I would like to return to what I said and want to address also all citizens of the country, not just the colleagues that are in the hall, but all citizens of Russia. Do we want to have here in our country, in Russia, parent number one, parent number two, and parent number three? They have completely lost it, instead of mother and father. Do we want our schools to impose on our children from their earliest days in school perversions that lead to degradation and extinction? Do we want to drum into their heads the ideas that certain other genders exist along with women and men, and to offer them gender reassignment surgery? Is that what we want for our country and our children? This is all unacceptable to us. We have a different future of our own. Let me repeat that the dictatorship of the Western elites targets all societies, including the citizens of Western countries themselves. This is a challenge to all. This complete renunciation of what it means to be human, the overthrow of faith and traditional values, and the suppression of freedom are coming to resemble a religion in reverse, pure Satanism, exposing false messiahs. Jesus Christ said in the Sermon on the Mount, "By their fruits ye shall know them." These poisonous fruits are already obvious to people, and not only in our country, but also in all countries, including many people in the West itself. I think that's great that he's pointing out this gender ideology as being central to what the West is promoting. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this today?
Well, in my Putin book, in his mind, this came out in 2012, all of this is connected. You can't have this oligarchy, this capitalism that rapes other countries without denying what a human being is. This is purely satanic, because Satanism is an inversion. The material over the spiritual, the passion over the intellect, these are all connected. So what they do economically in country X, they do morally and even medically in country X. And they're all connected. Because if you really accept all this, then how could you possibly reject oligarchical capitalism? On what foundation? You can't even stand on human nature to criticize any of this. This is the anti-culture, and it's connected to U.S. military policy and to their economic policy.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless, and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.